One of the problems with preaching on Pentecost, just like the same problem is with Christmas and Easter, is to tell the story in a way that doesn't describe it as just something that happened once upon a time, past tense. But we also have to see and tell the story as a story that continues to happen to us today. Otherwise, what we will have is merely a nice history lesson and not much more. By way of context, the community that Jesus is speaking to is John's community in today's gospel lesson, which was marked by a great divide between those who believed in Jesus and those who did not. The lines of demarcation were as strict as the tensions between Peter and Paul over the dietary codes. It was, in fact, one of the great rifts within the early church. But Jesus spells out for his disciples in no uncertain terms what the Spirit will do when it arrives. Rather than continuing to divide us, the Spirit of God is going to bridge the two worlds. It's going to bridge the world of man and the world of God. The Spirit will function both in the church and outside of the church in the world. For those outside of the church, the Spirit will bring to their attention the meaning and the reality of sin, of righteousness, of what constitutes righteousness, and of judgment. And for the church, the Spirit will show us how to interpret the new contexts and the new ethical situations that will come our way as disciples of Christ. Just as Jesus guided the first disciples, so now the Spirit is come to guide us. So the question becomes, where do we see the Spirit functioning in the world today? As I write this, there are conversations, for example, taking place all over this country about the sin and the broken relationships that exist between the races in our country, which is a good thing. But without the events of Missouri and New York and Baltimore, those conversations about the reality of sin amongst us could not have happened, would not have happened, in fact, because none of us would have wanted to deal with it. None of us likes to deal with uncomfortable topics. None of us want to deal with the issues of sin, especially when it gets close to home. But it is the work of the Spirit that makes that happen in the world. It helps us to see that God will not let the issue go away. It's the Spirit that bridges the realms of the church and of the world and calls us to be aware of how it moves back and forth between the two. But what is the Spirit telling us? Jesus tells the church that God's Spirit will prove that the world is wrong about sin, that it's wrong about righteousness, and that it's wrong, too, about judgment, that it is wrong about sin because the world does not believe Jesus, or for that matter, anyone can possibly forgive sins. Wrong about righteousness because Jesus is rising at Easter and again at the Ascension, are acts of justice that the world cannot see, so it disbelieves in them. Since the world cannot see God's Spirit, it thinks real power lies in the hands of those who were able to put Jesus to death in the first place, and in the laws that justified his death, the death of an innocent man. But the Spirit testifies to the church, and it asks the church then to testify to the world, that there is another greater truth out there in the world. Death does not win. Death does not get the last word. Life does. Life eternally does. This past week, I've been following news items throughout the course of the week because there's not much else to do when you're on your back. And a jury sentenced Jokhar Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber, to death for 4 murders, dozens of maimings, hundreds of shrapnel and other injuries that he and his brother caused, including the persistent deafness and many of the noises that were generated by that explosion. His story and the story that surrounds him illustrates the great tension that still exists between the world of man and the world of God. The jury felt that Tsarnaev showed no remorse in his months of sitting before them while the testimony of those who had been injured was given. There was no argument about his guilt. His lawyers admitted that from the very get-go, and we've all seen the videotapes that showed us Joe Carr and Saranoff and his brother in the crowd that fateful day, placing their bombs beside the Richard family and their three children, returning to the subway very calmly as if nothing was about to happen other than a complete indifference and regard for life. The jury was given strict instructions for making its decision on each charge, how it was to find the defendant guilty or innocent, which were all legally framed. But missing from all of this was the consideration of the truth that Jesus speaks about, that proves the world is wrong about sin and righteousness and judgment. From the man on the street to the jury in the courthouse in Boston, the common argument was that forgiveness was indeed impossible in this event. Even Zokar's attorneys agreed with that. And for many, righteousness, meaning justice in a situation like this, was the penalty of death. That was the righteous decision to make. Now, there were some interesting exceptions to this, though. Polls of the citizens of Boston, those most immediately affected by this horrific act, were overwhelmingly in favor of life in prison rather than death. But as you move away from that center of where the tragedy started and happened out into the greater context of our country as a whole, the nation, 2/3 of the nation is in favor of the death penalty. And some notable Catholic laity, mainly the chief of the Boston police, for one, and the family of Martin Richards, the very boy that was killed, who died, whose sister and mother were badly injured, whose brother has post-traumatic stress disorder, and whose father has shrapnel wounds and some hearing loss, declared that not only their faith, but also their peace of mind needed a sentence of life in prison rather than death. One lonely Catholic keeping vigil outside of the courthouse happened to be an Iraqi war vet. And this Iraqi war vet said no one should be sentenced to death for the worst day of his life, echoing Jesus' assertion that the world is wrong about judgment. There was a battle in the court over allowing anti-death penalty advocate Sister Helen Pregen, you may know of her, as she testified for the defense. She was asked to testify, and there was some concern as to what she could offer that would be relevant. If you saw the movie Dead Man Walking, it was Sister Pregen who was the one that was assigned to the killer in that context to help him face what he had done and to help make peace with God before his execution. In the end, though, she was allowed to speak, but not to all of the questions that she wanted to testify to, only to those about her visits with the suspect in question. Not to speak about the truth, though, as she understood it, that was not going to be allowed. Not to speak about mercy or justice or judgment from a Christian perspective or the spirit of Jesus. She was not allowed to speak about any of that, though that's really what she's an expert in. There was a complaint among many that Saranoff showed tender feelings only one time throughout the entire court dealings, when his elderly aunt, who had traveled all the way from Russia to speak about his childhood, was so overcome with panic and hyperventilation that she could not speak. And tears came to his eyes at that moment when he saw his aunt. And she could not speak, and he sobbed once. And the people said he only had tears for himself. He was only crying for himself. But I think not. I think his tears were really for his aunt. And I think that the reason that they were for her is that he had to face the truth. Just like the fella in the movie Dead Man Walking eventually had to come to face the truth of what he had done and the weight of what it meant to take another human life. That what he had done and what his brother had done, even though they thought they were doing so for justice, perverted as that may seem, for her and for her people, had actually, in fact, caused her great pain and great harm and great hurt. It was, in fact, the last thing that she would have wanted from him and his brother. And thus, a condemnation like no other on what he had done. That here was a woman that he could not run away from. Here was a person sobbing who he could not comfort. And the thing that bothers me most about all of this is that the belief in Jokar's common humanity, the belief that there is a possibility of human transformation, belief that at 21 years of age he could still grow in spirit and in heart, belief that he might just in fact still be a child of God, all of these beliefs were pushed away. The herd of reporters that was covering the trial declared these things unconvincing. We are accustomed to proclaiming that Jesus committed no crime and had no sin. But what he wanted us to see was that no one should be killed. That he embraced the guilty man beside him on the cross on Calvary, and he embraces the guilt that is in all of us still today, and does not want anyone be destroyed, offering the one thing ruled inadmissible in a court of law, belief in the power of redemption. That is not a legal argument. That is not a legal thing that can be offered. And so once again, the old adage of an eye for an eye takes precedence over what Jesus would have us do. Once again, no matter how justified we might feel about this, each time that we do this, each time our society or we participate in this, no matter the reason, the church fails to proclaim and stand up for what Jesus proclaimed and stood up for. After all, if he can forgive a common criminal that's dying with him on the cross, why can't we? What is it in us that allows us to think that we can be different than Jesus? The Church of Jesus Christ, you see, every time it fails to follow its leader, loses some of its vitality. It loses some of its credibility. The church has to stand for things different than the society in which it finds itself stands for. If it doesn't, then why is it here? What is the point? Are we just to mouth what others are saying? Are we just to say, yeah, that's right, whatever society says makes sense, let's just do it? Are we to do that because it's just too difficult to say, no. Jesus, I know it's not popular. I know that the society demands retribution and justice, but Jesus, nonetheless, as a Christian, calls me to say no to that. When is it that we stand up for Christ? Exactly. And each time we decide to follow the dictates of someone other than Jesus Christ, be it the law of an eye for an eye or our own desires, just to fulfill whatever we want to fulfill on our own, we diminish the power of Jesus' Spirit and we beg the question, why are we here? What are we really testifying to? And if we don't follow Christ, who is? Who will? Frederick Buechner, one of my favorite authors, wrote some years ago, and I think it's very insightful for us. He wrote this. He says, does the Spirit of God move over the face of the turbulent waters of our age today? Does it? The Hebrew word for move is merapeth, which means to brood, as a bird broods over its nest until finally new life begins to stir beneath that sheltering body that is protecting the eggs. It is new life stirring in this death-ridden world. Is there any new life, signs of it? Or is it just the same old, doing what we've always done, taking another life, thinking somehow that that brings back the life that was lost in the first place? Is light about to be created out of our darkness, Buechner asks? This is the only question that matters today, in a sense. And this is the question that stands before the church at Pentecost, on the birth of it. Is this church still being born in Jesus' likeness, in his image, in his way, in his truth today? Or has it been co-opted? Amen.